Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. Social movements have been a big part of our history. We've come a long way since the Boston Tea Party, suffragist parades, the anti-war and civil rights movements. Or have we? We have two experts with us to discuss protest movements, their history, and their effectiveness. Joining me in studio is Sunita Parikh, political science professor at Washington University. Her specialty is conflict and protests. T.V. Reid is a professor of English at Washington State University. He is the author of The Art of Protest, Culture and Activism from the Civil Rights Movement to the Streets of Seattle. He joins us by phone. Thank you both so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Professor Reid, good to have you with us. I'll start with you, if I may. Taking note of the title of your book, The Art of Protest, is there really an art? Is it an art form?
I think in many respects it is. I'm actually talking in the book about the ways in which various art forms, music, murals, poetry, have been used in movements. But I think carrying out a movement is also an artistic endeavor in the sense of you have to think through the craft, you have to think about audience, you have to think about the ways in which you use various messages, and the way that you craft an overall picture of the world. So yes, I think it's an art form. It's a messy art form. It's an art form that's never conducted by a single individual. It's always a collective process, and again, one that has fuzzy edges at all times.
It seems to me that so many of them, you talk about working things out beforehand, so many of them are spontaneous, where that is less likely.
Well, I think spontaneity is sometimes exaggerated. There's an awful lot of behind-the-scenes work that goes into a movement before it emerges into the public imagination. And so sometimes, something like in 1960 when the student sit-ins began in the South, people thought, oh, these are spontaneous. But in fact, there have been months and months and years of progress and organizing behind those movements that seem spontaneous. But once a movement starts, spontaneity can kind of take over. It can spread very quickly. And I think that's part of the story of how movements work in any context.
Professor, what do you think about this the spontaneity factor?
Well, I agree with Professor Reid that often that there in movements you do see planning before the events that we think of as sort of coming out of nowhere. But I would also say that there are spontaneous events that then generate activity on the part of people, which then can become a series of planned events. So, for example, in Ferguson, when Michael Brown was killed, one of the things that we talk about when I teach protest is, to what extent was what happened then and then the aftermath where his body was left outside, where people started to gather, how did that facilitate a larger movement or a larger protest activity taking place? So I think the way that spontaneous and strategic or planned work together, they do work together, but it varies depending on the event.
What makes an effective protest or demonstration?
Well, that's something we spend a lot of time thinking about. You can measure it in terms of there being a goal that you reach. So if the protest is in service of something else, then if that goal is achieved, a policy is changed, for example, or a policy change is even brought forward, that people start thinking about it, that's one way it can succeed. It can, in my own work, sometimes I just count success as, was it produced? Did it actually turn into a protest? Because one of the hard things about studying protests and demonstrations is you don't study the ones that fail. And it's hard to find them.
Well, I was just going to ask. Oh, go ahead, Professor Reid. I think you wanted to get in. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to add that I think there are many ways of evaluating success. And sometimes the success is simply getting an issue out into the public mind. People have criticized the Occupy movement, for example, for not having a clear agenda, a clear set of demands. And yet we are clearly, as a country, talking more about income inequality than we ever have. So that series of events around the Occupy movement certainly changed the public conversation. That's a success, even if it didn't have specific demands that had been achieved.
Professor, in studio, you mentioned failures. Can you come up with a significant failure that we would know about that didn't develop into some act?
Well, I can't think of one off the top of my head that audience would know about. But I do have one because I've studied smaller violent events more than I study big social movements, although I've studied the civil rights movement and written about it. But when I was studying violent events in India, there were attempts to get protests going. We have a lot more of them in India than we have in the U.S. And there was an attempt to get a big protest going, and it fizzled out. They got a few people out, but it didn't take off. It didn't last. And so I've seen them there, and I've sort of tracked them.
We don't often hear think of violent protest demonstrations in India, probably because of Gandhi.
Right.
Yeah. But they do have.
They do. They have quite a few. And, you know, even when people are, when the movement is, or the activity that's being put together is nonviolent, it can wind up being violent because of, you know, police activity or another group coming in. Can I pick up on something Professor Reed said about Occupy? Because I think that's a really important point. Mm-hmm. That, yes, I would say I agree that Occupy changed the. Change the way that the conversation went. But I also think that Occupy illustrates something of a generational difference, because people in my age category were more likely to say, but what is your goal? Where is your leadership? Where is your organization? And in the case of Occupy, they were successful in getting people together and persisting with a much more decentralized focus. And I think they deserve a lot more credit than they often get.
Professor Reed, have protest demonstrations and social movements essentially changed over the decades? I don't want to take it back too far to ancient history, but your area is from the 60s on. Have they changed?
I guess part of the answer, yes, it would be a typical professorial one. Yes, in some ways there are great continuities. When people talk about the Black Lives Matter movement, they almost invariably talk about it in relation to the civil rights movement. They also talk about generational changes, and certainly the impact of social media, the internet, has changed the nature of some kinds of organizing. It's made certain kinds of organizing easier, certain kinds of connections between people much easier. However, in terms of the forms used in protests, marches, sit-ins, die-ins, various kinds of nonviolent protests and ones that hedge into riots, that's remained pretty constant over the decades. I think in terms of the social media moment, it's also very clear from the...
Hello. I think we've lost the professor there. Right in the middle of the comment, we'll try to get him back. Let me pick up with you,
sure.
Professor, with regard to that. Do you want to just follow his remarks?
Yeah, I tend to agree that we see a lot of, we have different ways of coordinating each other, right? So it's, in some ways it's easier. If you think about when I've studied, you know, how do people get the word out? It can be something like rumors. We used to have in the olden days telephone trees to get people. Now you put something on Twitter, or you put something on Facebook.
Still using the telephone, of course.
Still using the telephone, just not in the way that we grew up using it. And that makes getting a lot of people aware of the issue much easier. But you still have to get people out. You still have to get them to the site, because, I mean, I feel that I should be able to pull up some ideas that where they're purely internet. I mean, certainly you can see boycotts and sort of outrage that percolates through social media that can get companies to change their policies, for example, or withdraw something. But I don't think that works as well for government, you know, for public issues. Right. I think there you have to physically be there.
How would you assess the Black Lives Matter movement in terms of its success? It is alive and well. Obviously, it's not what it was 2 years ago, but it is still out there.
It's definitely still out there. Yeah. And I think that what it has created is a network and a reservoir. So a network of activists, for one, who can coordinate and can look at new possibilities to pursue their goals through activism. And I also think it's created an audience for that. What I mean by that is an audience of people who aren't necessarily activists all the time, or even most of the time, but they're a reservoir. Mm. They're a reservoir of support.
You know, one of the things that happened, particularly during the early days of the movement and post the Michael Brown shooting, is the fact that there were a lot of people who were supportive of what Black Lives Matter was trying to say and mm-hmm. the issues they were trying to bring forward. But they were turned off by the tactic, so that they were, in fact, losing allies while they were demonstrating.
Yes, I think that because our main memories and knowledge of protests are the civil rights movement, the women's movement, we tend not to remember how messy and difficult and sometimes violent they were. And so when you're in the middle of something that's going on, you see all that inchoate sort of emotion. Mm-hmm. And yes, when you see Americans in particular it's been a long time since we had sustained violent protests in this country. And when we did have them, they were in a time of great upheaval. And so people, I think, react to that in a way. They don't see it as what the great historical sociologist Charles Tilly called politics by other means.
No, what they see is a building burning down.
Exactly.
and people taking television sets out of stores and that sort of thing.
And that's one of the enduring aspects of big movements is there are always going to be violent people who come into it. They're always going to be opportunistic people. And so if you can't, and it's difficult for the people who are not opportunistic to separate themselves right. and not be sort of grouped with them.
I understand the TV Reed is back with us now. I hope that's true. Are you there, sir?
I hope I am. Can you hear me?
We sure can, yeah.
Okay, let me just add a few things to that.
Do, first please.
All, a recent study done by Pew, one of the major research organizations in the country, found that about 55% of African Americans support the movement and about only 12% oppose. And more interestingly, more than 40% of whites support the movement and only 28% oppose. The rest either have no opinion or do not even know about the movement. I think if you took those figures back to the days of the Martin Luther King protest, you'd find that they were probably even less supported. So we need
right.
to be careful in thinking historically about this. King is now a kind of sacred figure, but back in the day, he was considered a purveyor of violence, not because he did, but because that was the perception, and the movement had violence all around the edges, much of it provoked by the anti-civil rights activists. But still, we need to be careful when we think about these movements historically that as Professor Arik said, there's always messy edges around any kind of movement, including ones that are historically, and as Black Lives Matter, is committed to nonviolence.
Well, we have to take a break, and we'll do that and come back and continue this conversation. We are talking about protests and how they have changed or not changed over the years and decades. With me in studio is Professor Sunita Parikh, political science professor at Washington University. Joining us by phone from Washington State is Professor T.V. Reed of Washington State University. We'll come back and continue our conversation in just a moment. If you'd like to get in to this discussion, we'd love to hear from you. Give us a call at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. You can send us an email to talk@stlpublicradio.org or send us a tweet to STL on air. This is St. Louis on the air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Now back to our conversation on protests and demonstrations with Professor T.V. Reed from Washington State University and Sunita Parikh, Professor of Political Science at Washington University here in St. Louis. Professor Reed, let me come back to you with the subject of leadership of these protests and demonstrations. When they are not spontaneous, it's a different situation than when they are spontaneous. What about the leadership component to these situations?
Well, as Professor Parikh noted, and not just in this movement, but in many contemporary movements, there's a strong critique of hierarchy, of kind of, downward from the top kind of leadership. There's much more collective leadership, shared leadership, shifting leadership, which I think confuses the media when they're looking for a spokesperson. But in fact, it's the essence of democracy, and particularly a movement that's trying to extend democracy in different ways. It makes sense to have non-hierarchical structures. The BLM is a very diverse, very while there is one organization that has the name Black Lives Matter and about 30 affiliates around the country, those affiliates are independent. They have their own, you know, internal structures, and you could call them leaders, but again, they tend to be shifting leaders rather than a single leader over time. And I also think that those networks are much broader than those kind of individual organizations that call themselves Black Lives Matter. There are over 100 organizations that have committed themselves to a manifesto about these issues that are from all different segments of African-American community, African-American organizing around the country.
Professor Parikh, anything to add to that?
I would definitely agree with that. And I think that in some ways, again, the fact that the civil rights movement is paradigmatic makes us expect, or the nonviolence movement in India, the independence movement with Gandhi, we expect this world historical figure. But that's not the norm. That's the exception. And even then, there were fights within the civil rights movement, within the competing organizations. But that's not part of our retrospective narrative.
Yeah. We have a caller. Yeah. Go ahead, Professor Reed, and then we'll take a call.
Yeah, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, which was in many ways the most important organization of the civil rights movement, had the same kind of non-leadership method. They used what they call group-centered leadership, and that's really something basically created by Ella Baker, the great civil rights activist who worked both for King's organization and for the student movement, which was a much more, again, anti-hierarchical, non-leadership organization. So, this is new and not new.
And yet certain names do stand out from that era. I think of Stokely Carmichael and H. Rapp Brown and people like that. They got a lot of ink in the day.
They did, and they're not particularly typical. In fact, there was talking about arguments within the movement. When certain people like Carmichael became leaders, they were really going against the ethos of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. It greatly changed the organization, and there was much conflict around that. And some of them were criticized as being kind of media mavens rather than serious organizers.
We'll get to the media in just a second, because clearly that has played for a long time a big role. But I want to bring Stephen in because he wants to stay with Black Lives Matter for just a moment. So, Stephen, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey there. Yeah, I wanted to comment specifically about the tactics they were using. I heard it just a few minutes ago about how they're using the same tactics that we're using the civil rights movement, and how we haven't seen violent protests for a long time. I think that's really counterproductive. We're in a completely different area of our social strata where this is the information age. The original tactics used in the 1950s and 60s for the civil rights movement were used not only to say, hey, we need to fix this, but to draw attention to the issue in the first place. But, I mean, we already know Ferguson was not just national news, it was international news for weeks. I think shutting down bridges and doing all the other stuff that we see Black Lives Matter doing on a regular basis is not just alienating people because they're not accomplishing their goal there, but also because the people stuck in traffic can say, hey, you know, I'm getting stuck in traffic because there's these protesters on there. I'm going to have to pay an extra $100 to my daycare because I'm going to be late to pick them up, or, you know, I just need to get home because I have an upset stomach. They're creating as many enemies as they are. They're probably creating more enemies, I think, than they are friends by doing what they're doing.
Stephen, thank you for the. I think we talked about that a little bit earlier on, but I'll bring Professor Reed into that part of the conversation. What do you think?
The exact same critique was offered back in the 50s and 60s, that it was inconvenient to have these marches disrupting things. And again, evidence suggests that online organizing is never enough, and that is also tied in with protest marches and sit-ins and die-ins and bridge blockade, which again are very old forms. And in fact, it does basically make the message, this issue is not going to go away. Yes, there's information about it, but historically, these kind of issues tend to pass pretty quickly. The media has to always find new things to talk about. And so if we just sit back and let the information age take over, it's very likely that these issues will go under the table again and nothing will really change. I think that's the point of people continuing to make demonstrations, marches, events that yes, they're disruptive, they're inconvenient, but the argument I think would be made by Black Lives Matter, and again, I am not speaking for them, I'm not a member of their organization. I think the argument would be it's a minor inconvenience compared to being shot dead without having done anything criminal. I think that's really the issue at hand. How much a little inconvenience in your life might, in fact, instead raise conscious about an ongoing series of pretty horrendous situations.
Professor Parikh, yeah. It doesn't seem to me that the demonstrators have many options.
Yes, I think you're exactly right. You're in a no-win situation, yeah. Because if you behave well, then you don't get much publicity, and you probably won't get what you're looking for because you didn't get it before. You won't achieve your goal. If you behave badly, you will at least get some publicity. Yes, you will definitely raise animosity against you.
Well, that's what brings us to where I wanted to go for at least part of this discussion. That is the importance of the media. I'll start with you, Professor Parikh. The importance of the media to any movement.
Well, it's always been important. Getting the word out was true in the 18th and 19th century, too, with broadsheets and, you know, rumor mills and word of mouth. But now it's critical. And there's just so much. There's such a glut of information that we wade through. The one thing I wanted to point out about the immediate aftermath of Ferguson is all media are not created equal, because it was really Twitter. That it was really Twitter that put the protests, the event and the protests, on the national map.
No question. What I'm thinking of are those television pictures that go into every home and showed tank-like equipment being rolled out on the streets of Ferguson.
Oh, I think that they all work together. Mm-hmm. That had it not been picked up through social media, then you would have had fewer old, you know, traditional media showing up, because Twitter isn't enough. I mean, I certainly agree with that. It's not a big enough venue, but it rolls through all the different media now.
Twitter often brought the media, because that's how reporters would learn what was going on. What do you think, Professor Reed, about the media's role in all of this?
Well, again, I would point out there are many different media these days, and what's different in terms of historicity here is that there are more venues where activists can directly confront the world with their own messages, as opposed to always having to go through what we now think of as the mainstream media. It's also a generational question here. My son and most people of the millennial generation do not get their news from television. They get it from the Internet. And so, again, which media you're talking about, in what context, and who are the various audiences for those different segments of the community that listen to you and get information about what's going on in the world. So that's a major change, and I think that it's absolutely right that you cannot rely simply on the Internet, but conversely, you cannot rely on mainstream media to be the major voice of what's going on in the world anymore.
However, the young people can still see what's going on their phones. I mean, these pictures are streamed. They're taken on the spot and streamed immediately and there for everyone to see.
One of the things that does, actually, it frequently puts a contradiction between the kind of way that these images are framed by the mainstream and how the activists themselves frame them. It allows them to talk back to the ways in which they're being understood by larger media organizations. And that's a very interesting conversation, I think. Over time, you see these discrepancies, and people begin to be a little more careful in consuming mass media. They think more carefully about how the supposedly objective information is actually being framed.
That's a tremendously interesting point, I think, and certainly worth the discussion. Our time is winding down, but did you want to comment on that? One of the things I wanted to get to was the language of demonstrations, and that used by the media and used by the demonstrators themselves. You know, we hear the television commentators talking about riots and looting and things like that, and there are a lot of people who object to using terms like that sometimes. Professor Parikh, do you want to address that?
Yes, that's something that I've confronted in my own work and speaking, because having worked on violent collective action in developing countries, riot is often a descriptive term. It's not that people don't have pejorative views of it, but it's how we describe it. Whereas here, if you call something a riot, you are delegitimating it from the first moment. Mm-hmm. And so because of the way that violence is perceived, it's almost never perceived as legitimate. Mm-hmm. And so the language, by calling people looters, by calling them rioters, we are taking away the substance of those people who are in the protest.
Your thoughts, Professor Reed?
I think it's very much an issue of how you what terminology you bring into the issue. And I think, again, back in the 60s, when there were, from one point of view, riots going on in most of the major cities in America, in African-American and other communities, those who want to call them civil disruptions were thinking of them very differently than those who were calling them riots. That is, those who were saying that there were real issues behind these riots. These are not, and if there is looting going on, the looting is a reaction to a situation of extreme poverty that itself is socially created. It doesn't just fall from the sky. So, yeah, riot is a loaded term. There always will be debates about how to characterize these events, and that's part of the social movement struggle, to help define terms in a way different from the way that those who would oppose you are defining them.
We only have a few seconds left. I'll ask each of you this question. Currently, there's a lot of discussion in this country about a football player who was refusing to stand for the national anthem, Colin Kaepernick of San Francisco. That's an individual protest. Professor Reed, your thoughts about that, the effectiveness of that? He's certainly got people talking.
Well, that's exactly what it does. When any kind of person who has celebrity status, whether they're an athlete or in entertainment business, stands for, it does bring a different set of, a different kind of attention to the issue. And yes, it always means you're going to get criticism on the one hand, you're going to get support on the other. This is really no different than that. Same with, say, Beyonce's Formation video, which was very popularly and positively received by some and, you know, detested by others. It's always going to be the case that individual acts of either personal rebellion or creative art is going to be controversial in the context of movements that are themselves controversial.
And it's not new. I go back to 1968 in the Olympics and the Black Power salute by the runners, Smith and Carlos. That was a big deal.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Which made a big deal, in which they were stripped of their medals and have only recently gotten them back after we realized that, that was an unjust thing to take away the medals from them.
Professor Parikh, individual protest?
Well, I think that when individuals choose to make protests, if we look at them and they are principled actions, I think that you have to take seriously what it is that they're protesting about, what it means to them, why they would put themselves on the line like that.
And I guess you want to talk about effectiveness. We can look back to Cassius Clay or Muhammad Ali, and his day and what
and
happened.
And he paid the price.
Have to thank you both for being with us. This has been a very interesting discussion. Sunita Parikh, thank you for being with us from Washington University. Professor T.V. Reed of Washington State University, thank you, sir, for being with us.
Thank you very much.
This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.